Enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com. I'm HRN's Communication Director, Kat Johnson, with a preview of the next episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. We're exploring the future of eating animals, and we're going beyond typical meat sources.
If you look at the length of human history, we've been eating insects a lot longer than we haven't been in the United States and Western Europe.
We're looking at unusual ways to purchase meat.
People are like, really? Why would I want to buy that out of a machine?
And we introduce you to Frank Reese, a poultry farmer whose traditional farming methods are featured in a new documentary.
I'm a fourth generation farmer in Kansas, and I focus basically all on standard bred poultry and have my whole life.
He's kind of the last one standing with these rarefied breeds that are so important for if we're going to eat chicken and turkey into the future. He's essential. He's a national treasure.
Listen to Meat and Three this week to better understand the history and the future of meat. Available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum, and I love to talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. Here at Heritage Radio, we're in the midst of our annual summer fun drive, and it is both fun and fund with a D. We need funds to stay on the air and to keep having fun here in the studio. Heritage Radio is a wonderful nonprofit that brings you 35, maybe more now, weekly shows from heritageradionetwork.org, and I encourage everyone who hears this podcast to log on at heritageradionetwork.org/donate and help support us, please. Today's theme is why Wagyu? Beef. It's what's for dinner. Where's the beef? These two phrases are burned into the brain of everyone, myself included, who was alive in the 1980s. Beef has long been an important protein in the United States and continues today to be a staple on tables in many forms. Even as we've come to understand, we shouldn't be eating as much as we often do, and nobody needs a 24-ounce prime rib or the old 96er, as beef has come into focus as perhaps the worst offender when it comes to greenhouse gases related to agriculture, we still love it. I love it. It's delicious, and for those that raise it and raise it well, it's an industry and an economic driver. Of course, it's the same way for those that do it poorly, and as far as I'm concerned, you're better off eating MREs than poorly raised, slaughtered, and cared for beef. My guest today is Dave Yasuda of Snake River Farms. They're a more than two-decade-old company based in Idaho who raise, slaughter, cut, pack, and sell American Wagyu beef and Berkshire pork. It's a vertically integrated supply chain, and they're transparent about what they do and how they do it. And for that, I commend them. They make sure there's a use and a market for every part of the animal they slaughter, and they go to great lengths to provide an integrated economy as well, from their ranchers to their consumers. If we're going to eat meat, it should come from somewhere we trust. Wagyu is a Japanese breed of cow, prized for its intramuscular fat. Fat, after all, is responsible for a lot of flavor, and the grading system in many countries, including the US and Japan, take into account how much fat appears in the meat. In Japan, they raise full-blooded Wagyu, and there are a few people here in the U.S. that do that too, but the bulk of what we call American Wagyu is a cross between Japanese genetics and an American Angus or other breed. I've eaten more Wagyu than I probably need to have, and to be honest, the Japanese obsession with fat is hard to swallow sometimes, literally. It can just be too much. However, I think we can learn a lot from the Japanese in terms of portion size, and I encourage you to eat less beef, but eat better beef. In Japan, they raise Wagyu on things ranging from the conventional to the esoteric. My favorite is olive-fed Wagyu from Kagawa Prefecture. The cows are fed a diet that mixes in the leftovers from pressing olives for oil, and it makes their coat shiny and lush, and the meat delicious with more omegas than any other beef. Wagyu's prized in Japan, and the pricing can make someone from a highly subsidized food country like this one dizzy. Upwards of $150 a pound isn't uncommon for the best stuff. Perhaps Snake River Farm will start experimenting with some Idaho specialty Wagyu. Potato and onion, perhaps? Check out snakeriverfarms.com and use code FYE2018 for a 10% discount and free shipping on every order over $99. Check out the interview I did with Dave.
All right, we are rolling.
All right, man.
All right, so welcome, Dave Yasuda of Snake River Farms, to Feast Your Ears. when you meet somebody, you know, like on a plane. So we're sitting here in New York. We're in a conference room in Soho. On the plane here, if you sit down next to someone and they turn to you and they say, "Hey, what do you do? What do you say?
Yeah, I tell them I work for Snake River Farms. It's a company that raises American Wagyu beef. And then there's like, "Oh, it's American Wagyu beef." And Harry, I know you're up to speed on that, but for folks at home that don't
know. Sure, yeah, please explain American Wagyu.
So American Wagyu is, it's 50% Wagyu, and Wagyu is it's a breed of cattle. And so that's the cattle that's used for the famous Kobe beef.
Yep.
And then the other half is a continental breed. You know, people like to automatically go to Angus, and certainly we have Angus, but there's Charolais, there's many other breeds. And we try to select whatever that breed is based on what's the best. You know, it's like going to the market. So that's kind of how that all goes.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's American Wagyu, and what's nice about it is it's highly marbled. USDA Prime is the highest level of marbling in the U.S. 3% of all the beef in the country grades out at that level. But everything that Snake River Farms produces is above USDA Prime.
Wow, yeah.
And so if you aren't familiar with that, folks, it's intramuscular fat.
Yep.
So the more fat, the more flavor, the more juiciness.
Yeah, and when you are buying steaks in the marketplace, what people are often looking for is that intramuscular fat. And in the United States, we have only a couple of grades, right?
Mm-hmm.
With Prime being the top. When you go to Japan, where I feel like they get more, I don't know how to describe this, they get more intense, I guess, about everything. The grading system is far more complicated, and you have different numbers within different letters. You have the top being A5. So if you were shopping for Japanese beef, you might be shopping for A4 or A5, which, you know, I've been to Japan a number of times. I've eaten a lot of Wagyu there. I've visited Kagawa, mm-hmm. where they raise Wagyu. I mean, Japan has a lot of regional specialties with Wagyu.
Yes.
I heard recently about a place where they're raising them on tangerines or some sort of citrus. I imagine there must be places that they're feeding them kelp, things like that. And I went to a region where they're feeding them olives, and that, you know, very similar, I think, to Snake River, always grading at the highest here. The olive-fed Wagyu in Kagawa always grades out at A4 or A5, which is the highest, but I find that to be way too fatty. So how does Snake River compare to, say, a Japanese grade?
You know, that was one of the challenges of the brand. Snake River Farms is about 20 years old.
Sure.
And the company...
Which means you've been doing Wagyu in this country probably as long as anyone, right?
Probably. Yeah. You know, about that time, it seems like there were some Wagyu bulls that made over the States. And we try to talk, we have the history from inside the company, but then if you just Google it, I'm always interested to see what people have to say. But it seems like a lot of things hit at that time.
Yeah.
So, we have been doing it that long. And the thing that... Harry, now I've totally spaced on the question you started asking.
I was asking where Snake River Farms falls in a Japanese grading system.
In
like
the
if you've done comparisons. And
yeah, A5, we actually have some that will occasionally grade at that level.
Sure.
But we are actually targeting something lower. So
right.
The food is everything. You mentioned that diet. We don't do tangerines or olives. But our animals really do eat local.
Yeah.
And there's a couple reasons for that. You know, I think there is a terroir that goes with beef, you know, like wine. You were just mentioning that olive diet. I think that you said that imparts some qualities to the beef. But our animals, we have a group of scientists, really like PhDs who are work on the feed that's called a ration. And for each stage of life, there's a different ration that's produced. And when I was mentioning eating local, so we're in Idaho, there's often potatoes, there's soft winter wheat, there's molasses. And I'm going to start carrying a baggie around that ration because when you smell it, it's very appetizing. I mean,
sure.
It's like you could dig in with a spoon and eat
right,
for
right.
So I think that's really critical. I mean, you are what you eat for
everyone. Well, and I would imagine from a you know, just a direct farming and ranching perspective, it makes way more sense to be buying stuff from your neighbors than to be trucking stuff across the country or even across the world.
Yeah, I mean, there was a time when corn was plentiful and cheap, and I mean, that still is going to make it in the ration, but no, it doesn't. You don't want to spend the money to bring things in. And also, like you said, you want to work local. You establish relationships with local farmers, and that just makes a ton of sense.
So you guys are near the actual Snake River, I assume, in Idaho?
The American Falls, it started out, yes, we're in the proximity too, but our one thing that's unique about Snake River Farms is that we control, or at least we impact everything along the way, starting from the genetics, all the way to when the product is produced or slaughtered, the animals are slaughtered. We have our own production facility.
Oh, you have your own facility. Wow.
Which is unique, and we can control that. I think what happens if you talk to a lot of chefs that use our product, the reason they do, the quality is always high, and it's consistently high. Oftentimes, Wagyu programs are kind of bought on the open market.
Mm-hmm.
And not all of them, but that's what, you know, we hear people like, oh, I bought this, and my gosh, it was an amazing price. Yeah, and then I got, and maybe today it was fantastic, and then that quality may ebb and flow depending
on
where it was sourced from.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, that's very interesting that you have the control over that process, because, I mean, I used to own a butcher shop and
oh, wow.
Well understand the sort of sourcing vagaries in the meat industry, and, you know, on top of that, having worked with the Wagyu farmers in Japan, you know, you can only know so much when the animal's on the hoof. So, you know, you can look at the animal and you can think, well, I think it's going to grade prime, or I think it's going to grade A5, but you really don't know until it's slaughtered, and so much can happen in that slaughtering.
Oh,
and in the control of that animal and what happens to it. So if you're in a position where you are doing the best herd management and you are raising an incredible animal, all of that can get ruined if you send it to a slaughterhouse that doesn't treat it correctly.
That's absolutely correct. So, and that whole process is just important. So, Temple Grandin, you've probably heard
of course.
Temple.
I recently watched the movie.
Yeah. she designed the chutes or the entry points,
yeah.
The way the cattle enter the production facility. And, you know, at our core, we really have just a lot of ranchers and folks. Like, there's people in my office in Boise, you know, who work in IT, and at the end of the night, they go home and they work on their own small
herd. Their own small herd. Huh.
And so people are really close to the process,
yeah,
to the
absolutely.
Animals. And, you know, that comes up a lot. I mean, when I'm not really I was raised on a farm in Idaho, but I wasn't really in the beef industry. I worked for different food companies. And when this opportunity came up at AgriBeef, someone said, hey, this job sounds like it'd be perfect for you. And I thought, I don't know about beef. I mean, knowing nothing about the company, really not knowing that much about the beef industry. But it just kind of felt like it wouldn't fit. But once I met the people and you really start understanding the process there, it's unique. I mean, we're part of the beef industry, and
yep.
we understand that. We're not trying to... I think we try to be very realistic about everything. We understand
sure.
that if you want to be the most socially conscious, environmentally friendly product, it's probably not beef. But we do our best to ensure that we're being as sustainable as possible. You know, like, if you go to the plant... You should come to the plant, Terry.
I would love to. I actually... I have been to Idaho a couple of times. I had a really good time in Boise back in the early 2000s, and then actually my wife and I got engaged in Boise.
What?
Well, sort of by accident. I mean, not really. By
Would
accident,
she say
but,
accident?
Well, maybe. And so we went to see the Pixies, and it was in 2000. This would have been in early 2004, and. At the end of the night, I turned to her and I said, you know, do you think they would play at our wedding? And she looked at me and she said, well, you'd have to ask really nicely. And I said, well, ask you or ask the Pixies. So that was, we got engaged in Boise.
I love that story.
Yeah.
Maybe we get you, you know, you could be the poster child for Visit Boise.
So anyway, yeah, I mean, I would love to come and visit. So tell me a little bit about, you know, about like, what is your, like, what does the day-to-day look like at Snake River? I mean, obviously, you guys are doing a lot. So you're not just raising the cattle, right? You're doing the genetics. So, I mean, to go all the way back to the beginning, you're doing the genetics, which not everybody does. You are then, you know, then you have, the, then there's calving, then you're raising the cattle.
So, super quick. So, we have the genetics, we have a herd of bulls,
yeah.
You know, we have pure Wagyu animals. And, but what happens is we contract with farmers, so, you know, and they, the calves come out.
Yep,
they,
sure.
We have the calves, and then they raise them, you know, and they get to the point where then we can get them to the feed yard.
Yep.
So feed yard always has a super negative connotation. We do have the, I mean, you can see where, you know, almost all animals, ours in particular, they live for a year in these amazing grass-fed fields where they graze. Then they go into, and the feed yard, I know, has negative connotations, I just said, but, you know, these are designed specifically when you go there. I mean, you should come out.
Sure. Yeah,
out.
Yeah, I'd love to.
But then you could, have you been to other feed yards? Have you been to other cattle operations?
I have not been internally to other cattle operations. I've driven through feedlots in Nebraska. I've driven through feedlots in Southern California. Like, I've driven by them. I've never been in the facility specifically, but I've seen them from the outside.
So when you see it, I mean, the animal care is critical. There are no growth promotants used for the Wagyu animals. You know, one of the things that happens is, like, you can feed other breeds, and at a certain point, there's no more intramuscular fat, just forms on the outside.
Right.
Wagyu are unique in that it continues to develop that intramuscular fat.
Yeah.
And so the slow feeding process takes like about 500 days.
Yeah.
So they're on feed for 500 days. And like I said, there's different rations for different stages of life. And so that's a pretty serious commitment in time for the investment.
Sure.
In money.
And longer than conventional.
Yes, conventional can be like 180 days.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a much bigger, you know, so you're making a much bigger commitment to the quality of life and to the feed and to the final product ultimately,
yes.
Right? That's where that's really what it comes down to.
It is. So it's you know, the original idea was that the founder of our company, Bob Repholz, was in Japan, and he saw the Wagyu cattle, and he said, man, they don't have any land here in Japan. We should raise it in the United States and ship it back.
Oh, interesting. That was
that was the idea.
Original idea.
And then, you know, without going through cattle history or just, you know,
yeah.
Export, import, there's different things that happened, but it just wasn't as cost effective. Although
sure.
We do export to about 40 countries now.
Wow.
And a lot of that, though, are the other. We like to say we sell everything but the moo.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's hides, there's dried blood, there's all kinds
sure.
of different things that
yeah.
go to additional markets.
Well, which is great. I mean, which is
yeah,
great that you have a market for that. I mean, because I've certainly met and spoken to people where things like the blood and hides are just being trashed, right?
Yeah, which is a huge waste.
It's a huge waste. And really, if you're going to go to all this trouble and you're going to raise this animal, you really should use as much as you can.
And there are markets for it, too.
Yeah, of course.
So, you know, we have our executive VP of sales, Terry Reynolds, likes to... he and I sit in on these new employee orientations, but it's interesting. He breaks down his whole team, and when you look at the pounds of what's sold, like, the two people that handle all those secondary products handle the majority of the volume. You know,
oh, interesting. By pounds,
yeah.
By
pounds,
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
That's very interesting. So then to get back to sort of what the business looks like, I guess. So then you have the animals, and then they are slaughtered at a USDA
mm-hmm.
facility that you guys,
exactly.
you guys own.
It's in Toppenish, Washington.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then are the animals then butchered in that same facility,
into
final cuts?
Yes.
That will go out to restaurants and consumers?
Mm-hmm.
And you guys serve both. You serve both restaurants, and then you also have direct-to-consumer via your website?
Yes, we do. Well, and then, so, super quick, we have, we also produce, you know, Northwest beef under different brands, but, you know, more of a non-Wagyu animal. So, number one market for us, and again, in terms of sales volume, is going to be retail, so
yep.
just to the grocery stores. And we are, you know, we're big, but we're not that big. We, you know, people will come and say, hey, we'd love to have your beef in all these places. It's like, well, we only produce so much.
Yeah.
And so, which is actually nice. It puts us in a good position where you get the best relationships, and we can also make sure it's going to the right places. But in addition to retail, grocery stores, there is a food service. You know, so we go to the restaurant industry. And then we have an online component, snakeriverfarms.com, and that's where I work.
Got it. Very cool. And you grew up in Idaho.
I did.
Tell me about that. I mean, you grew up in Idaho. Your last name is Yasuda, so I'm assuming your family is not originally from Idaho.
They're not. I'm third generation Japanese.
Got it.
And so when the Japanese on the West Coast were sent to concentration camps
yeah.
during World War II, both my families ended up in that greater. It's right on the border. It's Ontario, Oregon,
yep.
Payette, Idaho. There are a lot of Japanese
yeah.
people that ended up there. But anyway, I was raised on an onion farm in Caldwell, Idaho. The population at the time was about 14,000, I think.
Wow.
So, there were... It's, you know, it's you can imagine Caldwell, Idaho, and it's kind of like you... You know, it's waving fields and, you know, open spaces. But, you know, as a kid, I hated it. You wanted to get out of it. You know,
sure.
I wanted to be out there and never go back. But...
Yep.
You know, created some interesting things because, you know, people talk about eating local. I think it's part of the Japanese thing, but, you know, my mom was an outstanding cook, but she and my father, if something was fresh, you ate it then.
Right.
So, like, we would have neighbors that would pick sweet corn, you know, when it would come on, and they would drop a bag off in the morning, probably like 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, and my mom would say, we need to eat this before it goes bad.
Right.
We're gonna eat.
So for breakfast.
I had corn on the cob for breakfast quite a few times.
That's it.
I got to tell you, it did taste pretty good.
Yeah, and I'll bet you if you waited until dinner time, it would not have tasted as good, right? I mean, like, you know, you talk about things being
comparatively
fresher,
yeah,
you know, like, I bet it would
have been
better.
Those kernels just kind of pop as soon as you put them in your mouth. Yeah. It's so fresh and really sweet.
Amazing. So both of your family was interned in my father's family
was. My mom's family, actually, the Amalgamated Sugar Company had a, when all the men went off to war, they needed people to work.
Yeah.
And they brokered an interesting deal with the U.S. government where they would take Japanese, people that were Japanese Americans that were interned, could work in the sugar beet factory. And so that's how my mom's father, my grandfather on my mom's side, signed them up for that in Nissa, Oregon.
Got it.
And there's a whole program that was put together. It's called Uprooted. And it talks about that. But one thing that, and I didn't know this, and I don't think my parents knew this either growing up, my grandparents did. Once they did that, actually, technically, they signed, the agreement was, you're technically free. So even though they'd been incarcerated.
Ah, got it.
A few people said, we see the loophole, we're out of here. But, you know, other people are like, where the hell are we going to go? So my mother worked in the sugar beet fields.
Huh.
But they set up schools and...
Yeah, of course.
You know, my mom actually...
Where were they living before that?
They were in Gresham, Oregon.
Okay. So they were already in Oregon. They weren't brought from, like, California or somewhere else.
Yeah. They did not move as far as many people did.
Right.
Think about what it takes to swim a coastline longer than the entire eastern seaboard and leap tall waterfalls in a single bound. What does it take to survive 200 feet deep in icy salt water? What would you be made of? Wild Alaska seafood is made of tight muscle mass, long chain omega-3s, and incredible micronutrients. It matters where your food comes from. Experience the flavor of the fittest in every bite and enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. Ask for Alaska on the menu, grocery store, or smart device. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
I'm Souther Teague of Amoria Margo and a co-host of The Speakeasy right here on Heritage Radio Network. You know, my favorite thing to do every week is to come here and be on the show. I have lots of jobs. I am a very busy person. And I do this because I love it. I get to sit down and talk to all my heroes for about an hour every week. It's incredible. And I hope that you enjoy it, making a great effort to share with you. And we'd like you to share back with us. It's our summer fundraiser, and we'd love for you to donate at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. You can click on the beating heart, and you can even choose shows that you'd like to donate to specifically. And you can also choose a recurring monthly gift. And for all that, we'd be greatly appreciative. Thank you so much.
You guys also do pork as well.
We do. Correct? We do Kuro-Buda pork, 100% Berkshire.
Yep.
You know, it's a nice match. The Snake River Farms has a tie to Japan, so the Kuro-Buda pork does too. Hams are kind of the big thing that we started working on. And but also just like, boy, I have to tell you, like the pork shoulders, the pork collar is probably my favorite cut.
Yeah.
Just super rich. And you know, the Kuro-Buda pork has really fine streaks of marbling, and the flesh is more red.
Yep.
Has a higher pH, retains more moisture.
Yeah.
That's the science of it. The bottom line is you eat that pork chop, it's pretty damn good.
Yeah, absolutely. And are those animals very similar, I mean, raised in the same area geographically as your...
Well, there's some primarily in Iowa.
Oh, okay.
Because, you know, it's the pork center. I've been... Those facilities are pretty amazing. And you have to put on, like, a spacesuit to go in, the Tyvek suit.
Yeah, yeah.
And because if there's any bacteria or virus that's in your respiratory system, you know, the pigs have a similar sort of immune system or lack thereof, and they can get ill. But, yeah, I was amazed. The farms have to be very far apart. Miles apart.
Sure.
Just so nothing spreads. And, I mean, those facilities were pristine. I was shocked.
Yeah.
I kind of had this vision of... I'm not that familiar. I had not been that familiar with pork production until
that
time.
Sure.
So.
Yeah. And then you guys do a lot of, you know, what in the meat industry is considered value-added products. So you do, I notice you do hot dogs.
We do.
You know,
have you had those?
I haven't, but
we'll have to get you some.
Yeah, they look really good. So, you know, we're coming up on, you know, probably the most American of holidays next week. and you know, with July 4th, and so that means it's time for grilling, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, you know, what are your favorite cuts?
You know, so the middle meats are always everyone's favorites, right? The ribeye, the New York strip, the tenderloin, and those are fantastic cuts. But you know, I really, especially for grilling season, I like the teres major. You know, it's the shoulder tender.
Yep.
It's fantastic. It looks like a little tenderloin.
Yeah.
That's a great one. And the one thing that's nice about all the American Wagyu beef, if you just do salt and pepper, it just has so much flavor. You don't need to do anything else. But, you know, while you're at it, it's great with the chimichurri. Harissa's good. In fact, that, you know, I love grilling that. We work with Chef Jamie Bissonette, and he kind of had some ways. And he likes to render the Wagyu fat, and then he puts, like, garlic and herbs in it, maybe some chili, and he bastes it with it and puts green onions on the grill and bastes the green onions with it, which is actually a great trick. I do it all the time now.
Oh, that's a great idea.
But then you cook those together and you can slice them like a tenderloin and just even like a smear of harissa paste, or if you throw some chimichurri, and it kind of elevates the barbecue
a little bit
or grilling. The other, all those, the other ones are outside skirt steak. Man, that one's a winner. There's no trick to that, really, just hot and fast. You know, if you had a plancha, that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Just, you know, if you have a big green egg or whatever, crank it up as high as you go, just sear. And that's probably one of the internal faves. Like, people love that in the office. Flank steak is fantastic. Flank steak, I do that sous vide a lot, even if I finish on the grill. If I don't know what I'm doing for 4th of July, but if I'm having a lot of people over, I'd probably do that. And
sure.
I can have
it.
Because
you can have it already.
Already. And then,
you
know, people are coming and going, and so you just have it sitting in the immersion circulator, you know, the tank's going, and then you just sear it and get it
ready. For that kind of thing, I really like pork ribs.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you're having a long day where you're basically just kind of hanging out, and, you know, I mean, it's one thing if you have a lot, you know, if you're trying to do burgers and steaks and all sorts of stuff on a grill, but if you're just going to do one thing, you can just set it super low and just let it sit there, right? I mean, and usually, especially
that's
with something like the Berkshire, like the Kuroboda, there's so much fat in it, it's intramuscular fat, it's just going to render out, and those ribs are just going to get better and better. And I did that recently at a barbecue on Memorial Day, and it worked out so well, and I hadn't done ribs in a long time, but I thought to myself, gosh, it was so easy, and you didn't have to touch it. I mean, you just had to, like, you had to make sure it didn't get too hot. I mean, that was actually the hardest part, was keeping the grill low enough, I felt like. But once you keep the grill low enough, you don't even have to do anything.
I love it. It
doesn't require the flipping of burgers and the checking.
I know. You think burgers and dogs are going to be easy, but it's like, like you said, they're going to dry out, do whatever. These other things, the ribs, I'm doing that, man.
Yeah.
Another cut that I like a lot is the flat iron. That's one that, it actually has so much flavor. It holds up well to a marinade if you want to do something.
Yeah.
I grew up in, so there was a place called the East Side Cafe in Ontario, Oregon. And it was where, if you go to the Boise Valley and ask anyone like of a certain age, had like 100 meals there. Just
oh, really? Yeah, it was that place.
Went there for prom. It was 50 miles away from Boise.
Sure.
But they had this dish called, it was essentially steak teriyaki. They called it green dragon steak. But with any of those cuts, like a flank or a flat iron, those are great cuts to do that where you, and I don't marinate it at all. I season it, salt, pepper, grill it, and then you use like just a classic teriyaki, you know, ginger, soy, garlic, maybe some red chili flake. And put that on there, sprinkling the green onions and sesame seeds, and it looks like you went to town on that. But it's super easy.
So, is there still a lot of Japanese influence in that part of the country?
You know,
in that area,
in Ontario, there is. It's my grandmother and three other Japanese women were integral to getting a Buddhist temple in Ontario.
Wow!
And so, if you go there, there's like, the one thing I do every year is there's a crab feed that there's an organization called the Japanese American Citizens League. It sounds kind of insidious, but it's not. It's just, you know, it's like a lot of old Japanese people hanging out. But there's it's a national organization, but they have a crab feed that is pretty spectacular. So we always make it up for that. But that's when you see the most Japanese people in one place. But there is a lot of agriculture, a lot of Japanese families are still farming out there.
Got it. And are they farming? I mean, are they farming for a Japanese market or an Asian market? Or are they farming mostly just for?
You know, it's going to be sugar beets, onions, potatoes. Yeah. You know, kind of those classic crops.
Big crops, yeah.
You're starting to see that change a little bit, not specific to the Japanese, but
sure.
You know, there's more demand for, you know, specialty vegetables.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you now have specialty, or you have more specific, I mean, grocery store chains. I mean, I think of some of that. Yesterday, I was in New Jersey. I went to H Mart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, H Mart It's a Korean grocery store.
Did you see some snake river farms?
I didn't look at the meat case, actually. I was running in to get a couple of things, but I do go there a lot, so I'll have to take a look and
yeah, each one of those carriers.
But one of the things that always amazes me is how many vegetables that are essentially local in New Jersey that they end up with starting this time of year, because they have farms now that are growing stuff for them. And they're things that we don't, I don't see at the C-Town or at the A&P, you know what I mean?
Like, that's cool.
You're seeing stuff. I mean, I was able to buy organic black beans that were in a Ziploc bag with like a little cutout paper label from this farm that's, all Korean. And I looked them up online, and they raise jujubes, and they do all this Korean fruit, and they do Asian pears, and they do like organic beans. And I guess one of the big places they sell them is through H Mart.
That's fantastic.
Fascinating, right?
That is. But that's kind of where we're seeing food swing towards.
Yeah.
People are more conscious. That's one thing that people say to me a lot about Snake River Farms is, when you go to a restaurant, depending on the caliber of the restaurant, it's like, I don't want to order beef. I don't know where it came from. I don't know what's happening.
Sure.
And many restaurants do label it Snake River Farms. You'll see it a lot. And a lot of people say, it gives me a level of confidence that I know where it's sourced.
Well, I mean, because we're living in this weird age, I think, especially as people are becoming more and more aware of their food and watching out for it, and are members of CSAs and things like that, and are aware of these issues of contamination, right? I mean, we just had that big thing with lettuce coming out of Arizona. And it lasted for weeks. I mean, it seemed like it went on forever. And they're like, well, we think it's all off the market now. But, we don't really know, right? And so, and then you see other, there have been issues with contaminated beef and things like that. And so it is scary. And so, really being able to know where the stuff is coming from, if you're lucky and you live in a place where you know the farmer and they're a mile away, that's awesome. But then if you are in a position where you're going to a restaurant and you do see someone like Snake River Farms, knowing that you guys have control over and are very careful with that entire process, and that you're doing it in a way that is sustainable and respects the animal, I mean, that stuff I think is really, it's valuable.
Yeah, I agree. And that's one thing I really enjoy about working for this company. So we try to be as transparent as possible. Actually, if you go to AgriBeef, there you could take a video tour of our facilities, including the production plant. There's no one else that does that.
Yeah.
Now, it's not on the homepage, but
sure,
we try to provide as much information as possible.
Yeah, no, that's great. So tell me about ramen. Boise. So, ramen and Boise are not, ramen I feel like is this sort of phenomenon. And certainly, in New York, I've seen it like blossom into this incredible industry. From the time that I've spent in Japan and even like growing up a little bit around Japanese, families, it's like, that's like after the bar. It is like a street food, but it's become this phenomenon. So you have ramen in Boise?
Well, yes and no. So, I grew up in Idaho, but I worked jobs in San Francisco, Seattle, and LA. I was in LA for, the longest period of time. So clearly exposed to it a lot. And, I was gone from Idaho for, 15-ish years. And I moved back, and I thought, well, it should be nice to have a bowl of noodles, and then there aren't any. And so I had some buddies, and we talked about it. At this time, there was a few people would menu it here and there, and they would call things ramen, and really it was noodles with something else, just maybe more udon or, something, but not really ramen. Anyway, my buddy Jason Farber, he owns a restaurant called Manfred's, and it's like a, started as a food truck, but he had a kitchen facility, and it's right next to a place called Woodland Empire Brewing. And Keeley and Rob Landerman are there. Keeley's half Japanese. Rob lived in Japan, but they both have really awesome palates. So we just started kicking some ideas around, and they said, well, we could brew some great beers to go with it. And Jason and I had been talking about, the way it started, he said, let's make ramen and have a party. So, okay. And he said, well, your house is bigger than mine. Let's do it at your house. I said, okay. He said, how many people do you think you'd have? I don't know, like 40. He goes, well, that's not enough. We need to do something bigger. So once he had a kitchen, Woodland had this thing together, and we put it online. We just advertised through, social media. And it's going to, people who eat ramen are going to think this sounds outlandish, but it was $30. I think $30, $35. I can't remember now. But you get two beers, you'd get a bowl of ramen. We'd have like some appetizer, and then you have like a dessert. So Woodland just went crazy. They did so many cool things. They did like a ginger saison, umeboshi Berlinerweisse. That might have been one of the best beers
Sounds
I've ever
great.
Had. It's fantastic, man. It's funny because I was talking to Rob and Keeley, and so they were talking about, you know, getting together, and they said, guys, we need to make this thing taste like umeboshi. And they're like, what? So they brought in some ume plums.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
this
yeah.
is what we're going for. But they also did, I think Kirin is like a, it's a white, it's a lager made with white rice. They did a brown rice lager version of that. Just all these cool things.
Nice.
But so Jason and I just started cooking ramen. We got pretty good at it. We're pretty good at it now, but we use Kuributa pork. We kind of do the David Chang sort of thing. We looked at David Chang's cookbook. We looked at Ivan Orkin's book.
Yep.
In fact, I was at the Hot Luck Festival last year in Austin. It's something that Aaron Franklin and Mike Thielen,
yep.
you know, they have this thing going on. Anyway, and Ivan was there. I'm like, and I'm not bragging about it. I meet a lot of famous chefs. You
sure.
know, I went to a barbecue and, you know, there's Jacques Pepin. We're hanging out drinking wine in Napa.
Yeah.
You know, all these, you know, we work with Hugh Atchison. We work with really cool
yeah,
people.
Yeah, of course.
But I saw Ivan, I'm kind of like, because I've been so
yeah.
ramen. So I went over and I was, hey, man, Snake River Farms. And that's always a good entree. And we
sure.
talked. And I said, later on, we're kind of having a beer. I said, hey, you know, I'm from Boise, Idaho, and I've been making ramen out there. He goes, really? Yeah, and I said, you know, we looked at your book and whatever. He goes, well, god damn it. He goes, I'm so happy to hear that. He goes, a lot of people thought I was being egomaniacal when I wrote that book, but I thought, you know, there's probably people out there in Boise, Idaho who want to make ramen. But he was really cool. He's like, so what kind of noodles? How are you doing your noodles? You know, what's in the stock? Tell me everything about it.
Yeah.
And he gave me a few tips. The biggest tip he gave me was you need to make your own noodles.
Yeah.
We've been buying Sun noodles. We had to FedEx them in because you couldn't get them in Boise.
Right, yeah.
But all that's changing. There's some Asian markets coming in. All this is like in the past 2 years.
That's great.
And so a place opened, and it was okay, but I thought, man, just hang in there, guys. And they're closed now. They moved to another place. So right now, I don't know, maybe we need to do something about it. Everyone's like, when are you going to open a restaurant? But I have an awesome job with Snake River Farms. It's like
it sounds to me like you could just keep doing the pop-up
yeah,
times a year, right?
Yeah.
And that would be
and
more fun.
Fun.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
That'll keep it more fun than making
yeah.
it into a restaurant kind of thing.
But there's an opportunity there.
Yeah, you should. I mean, maybe I can convince Ivan and maybe we'll come out and we can attend or something.
Yeah, come on out. Yeah. Ivan Ramen West.
Yeah, that'd be cool. I mean, you know, like I said, like I've had a good time in Boise, so you know, I don't see why it'd be definitely fun to go back. So one of the things I send out regular listeners to the show know that I have this questionnaire that I send out to people who are going to be guests, and I was really struck by your answer to favorite cookbook, which was the Silver Palette Cookbook, which was a cookbook that I grew up with for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, that was what my mom used to use all the time. And so I remember, like, when I read your answer, I thought, oh man, I really should go back and look at that cookbook, because I haven't looked at the recipes in it in a really, really long time.
It was a turning point for me. I've always enjoyed cooking. My mom, I grew up in a household, there were five kids, and my mom was an outstanding cook, but man, she cooked all the time. And I was interested in it. I said, hey, how do you make this? She's like, too busy. Get the hell out of the kitchen. But she, you know, finally she kind of saw I was serious and I would hang out and do things. But we had, like I said, I learned to make Japanese things. My mom kind of had a small catering business doing like this, you know, fried chicken's always popular. It's this chicken called mafa chicken that it uses fermented bean paste to
give
it this kind of tang. Anyway, she'd make that. She'd make shrimp tempura, different things. But, you know, so you went to college and I graduated and I was, when I finally started to kind of cook things at home, you know, getting past lasagna or whatever you'd make for your friends, I think my sister gave me the book and it was like, it opened up a whole new world to me. Just like, oh. And, you know, this is the thing that's funny. Today you travel and, you know, someone says, oh, try this cannelle or try whatever. You know,
yeah.
It's like, oh, you get to try. I mean, I'm reading this book. I have no flipping
idea
what
these things
are. So you make them, and there weren't pictures, and it's like, it tastes pretty good. I hope I did okay.
Right.
And then, you know, years later, you know, you travel. It's like, oh, so that's what that is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you raise an interesting point there, which is that, you know, in so much of these things, right, like even if the dishes that are being served and called ramen in places are not exactly what we think of as ramen, if they're delicious...
Yeah.
Then that's fine, right? And maybe they learned it from reading something and there was no picture.
Yeah.
Right?
You know, I need to lighten up a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I've certainly looked, I've spent a lot of time looking at old cookbooks, and you look at cookbooks from the 19th century and there are no pictures.
Yeah.
So you're just sort of like making an assumption of what it's supposed to look like, you know, and even what it's supposed to taste like and even what you're supposed to do. I mean, some of those recipes are incredibly vague.
Yeah.
So. Well, you know, it's been a real pleasure to have you on the show. People can find, you know, find out more at snakeriverfarms.com. And you can check out Snake River Farms on social media at Snake River Farms. And Dave, you're on social media at High Zoot.
Yeah, on my Instagram feed. So come on over and we'll talk ramen.
Awesome. Well, thanks very much.
All right, thank you.
I'll leave you today with a quote from MFK Fisher. The truth is that most bereaved souls crave nourishment more tangible than prayers. They want a steak. What is more, they need a steak. Preferably, they need it rare, grilled, heavily salted, for that way it is most easily digested and most quickly turned into the glandular whip their tired adrenals cry out for. Thanks for listening today. Check out snakeriverfarms.com and use code FYE2018 for a 10% discount and free shipping. Don't forget to head over to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and support this and all the other great shows here on HRN. Big thank you to David Tatasciore for engineering this show today and all the time. You can find Feast Your Ears as well as lots of other great shows at heritageradionetwork.org on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get podcasts. And please take a moment to like the show if you did in fact like it on any of those places. You can reach me via email, harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com, and you can follow me on social media, @thefoodballer. Talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.